This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, good morning. We all braved the rain and scary roads and whatnot, and I'm so glad to see you. I was thinking as we were chanting, first of all, the before lecture chant is a way to fluff up the teacher's ego before the talk. The unsurpassed part, and then 100,000 million kalpas. Y'all know what a kalpa is? A kalpa is when an eagle is holding a piece of silk in his claw and he flies over a mountain. A kalpa is how long it takes for the mountain to wear away. Yeah, that's a long time. First of all, I wanted to say something about Shogaku Zen Institute, which is one of your ancestors, Shogaku Shinryu Suzuki, was named for. Shogaku means auspicious peak. So the auspicious peak, we're here on it right now, and when we realize it, we're always on it. But this particular peak is dispensing Masters of Divinities, not as a diploma mill. We have a lot of courses online, and I encourage you to talk to me about it if you're interested. We're having our first graduation ceremony for the brave individuals who helped organize the Shogaku Zen Institute, and even before we had approval from the state of California to grant our degree, and they took it on and created the website and the paperwork for it. So we can talk about that more at lunch. The main point of the Shogaku Zen Institute is that ministers in the Christian tradition go to seminary. Am I right? They go to seminary, and at the end of the seminary, they get an MDiv. That's 2 years. And some of us have been studying Zen for 20, 30, 40, 52 years or so. So don't be disappointed, though. I won't levitate. Sorry. And we don't have anything that we can say to the world, I can help. Sometimes priests can do it, and sometimes people leave Zen centers and they have to end up doing work that doesn't necessarily teach others about a mindful life. So we'd like to make that a little more possible by granting a degree. And we will aggregate and accumulate practice periods and studies that you've done so that you can get to your 72 degrees with our courses and with what you've already studied. Okay. I also wanted to say something, because I haven't yet, about the Whole Life Buddha retreat. The practice that I did in Japan was at Tofukuji, and the founder, Eni Benen, was the one who came up with the expression, and that was, he was contemporary with Dogen. In fact, he may have been the reason that Dogen left Kyoto to head for the hills, because there was some question about who was going to get the first temple in Japan that was dedicated to Zen practice, and it was given to Eni Benen. Anyway, his expression was, if you sit Zazen for a minute, you're a one-minute Buddha. And if you sit Zazen for a day, you're a one-day Buddha. If you sit Zazen for your whole life, you're a whole life Buddha. And most of us, and myself included, need to sit for their whole life. It's not like we become some kind of enlightened being. We're still human, and we still have a lot of work to do. As my teacher in Japan used to say, even the Buddha and Bodhidharma go on practicing. So we do too. And that's what the Whole Life Buddha is about. And so we decided to have a retreat for those of us who are getting long in the tooth or having challenges, physical challenges, in order to be authentic. I broke my thumb a couple weeks before the retreat. In the next couple days, the cast will come off, so I saved the drama for y'all. Thank you very much. And all of us will need to make accommodations if we're going to practice for our whole lives. So we can learn from those who are already making accommodations. You'll only be able to sit for so long. Then you'll be sitting in a chair, and pretty soon you'll be laying down. So you want to be able to do your practice for your whole life. I've also been teaching from the Adrian Rich poem, Diving into the Wreck, which is about the exploration we make under thoughts and concepts and assumptions and teachings to find our authentic experience. And I wanted to mention that when she wrote the poem, Diving into the Wreck, which describes Zazen very well, there's a ladder and we go down deeper, that's our Zafu, and when we get there, we encounter the actual wreck, but not the story about the wreck. So this describes Zazen very well, but actually was written at a time probably when psychoanalysis was very prominent. And I just want to mention that. I also wanted to talk a little bit about why does it matter? I'm going to talk about the development of awareness today because that's our principal business function here as Zen people. We're developing our relationship with awareness. It doesn't come or go. The awareness itself is here. Whether or not we actually relate to it is a different matter. But the reason I wanted to talk about awareness today is because that's what I always talk about, number one. But number two, I wanted to talk about, share with you some of the particular hazards in doing Zen practice. We talked about it last night, and that is spiritual bypassing, where we use the practice to repress our emotions rather than to know them and the texture. So actually, I was writing an article for Barry Magid, and it's for a psychoanalytic journal. It was about Buddhism and psychoanalysis. He said, oh my God, I have these idealistic people who talk about the infinite wonder of practice and don't talk about the dark side. I need your voice. So you didn't know that about me, but I'm telling you, that's why people call me. They want to hear the dark side. And I get calls from all over the country, particularly from women who've been involved in sexual abuse in the Sangha. And so it isn't so much about, as Barry Magid said when he asked me to do this, he said, I know you agree with me. It's not just a few bad apples. It's a systemic problem, the problem we have. And the problem is that the Sanghas don't know how to confront their teacher. My Sangha, I hope they do. I mean, maybe so. But the reason being why I wanted to talk about the reasons why it's hard to make sure that we have a wholesome practice. What are some of the social dynamics that lead to this kind of state of silence and acceptance around things that shouldn't be happening? So if we look at the studies of cult dynamics, and I'm not saying Zen is a cult, I want to examine the ways that cults get people to believe in them. And I think you might recognize some things here. That doesn't mean that what we're doing is cultish. It means that we need to be aware of those dynamics. And the only way we can be aware of those dynamics is by being aware. So I'll talk about the awareness in a little bit. So we have zealous and unquestioning commitment to a leader as number one in cult studies. So the mystique of a Roshi that traveled from Asia here is advocated, and even questioning teachers' actions can be discouraged. One may hear resistance such as, how can we as ordinary human beings understand the actions of a Buddha? Well, you can. Particularly because even though they may have great wisdom in the Buddhist world, their body actually exists and their sexual parts exist in this world of form. So it's the same as it is for us. They're human beings. Another characteristic is discouraging dissent and analytical questioning. Some of you may understand that Buddhists are very conflict averse. They like to be peaceful, and they don't like to talk about the things that aren't going quite as well as they want them to. And there are expressions. Sungsunim's only don't know, beginner's mind, and think non-thinking from Dogen. Now, these are all very important expressions when you're on the cushion. They're not so important when you're in the world of relationship. Then we do have to think and discriminate. Okay, number three, use of meditation, chanting, or breathing exercises. You didn't know that the cults all make use of this because it changes the brain waves. All of this has an effect. We do these things. Does that make us a cult? No, but we need to be aware of how we come under its spell. And sometimes you'll go to a teacher and say, I have this or that problem. And rather than examine the problem, they'll say, you need to meditate more. Let go of it. And actually, maybe that person needs some form of therapy. Okay, number four. Leaders or the community dictate personal choices in clothing. Occupation or relationships. And actually, they have done MRI studies of people who are in a group where, remember Zimbardo did that study where he took the Stanford students and some of them wore the clothing of the guard and some of them wore the clothing of the prisoner. And he had to stop the experiment because the guards took on cruelty and abuse. Okay, so just the clothing dictates various things. It dictates hierarchy. It dictates belonging. And so we pick up on the hierarchy in the group by the colors we wear, by the robes we wear, and by our shaved heads. Now, also women may be discouraged from wearing jewelry. And in an ongoing vow to Darlene's lineage, I always wear earrings, even for the most formal ceremonies. So the loss of personal style or accoutrements, even though there's some involvement maybe in loss of self-clinging, it can facilitate a conformity to a group, to the group norms, and this can actually be measured with MRIs. It actually changes your brain. Okay, number five. The group claims exalted status for itself. So some religious groups claim they have access to a supreme being and his or her approval, and a more favorable alignment with positive life outcomes. It seems that many members of religious groups believe that their perspective is the best. I know we don't think that. We don't think that at all. Even though we chant, I take refuge in the Buddha as the perfect teacher. I take refuge in the Sangha as in the Dharma as the perfect teaching, and I take refuge in the Sangha as the perfect life. Even though we say that, we are not exalting ourselves. Ha! So, I had heard a Tibetan teacher say that by doing Buddhist practice, and it was somewhat humorous, it's like getting an airline upgrade so you can receive a better incarnation in your next life. Number six, the group or teacher is not accountable to legal authority. There are only 13 states in the United States that have penal statutes that in at least some circumstances support criminal prosecution of clergy persons who have engaged in a sexual relationship with adult congregants or practitioners. We are not one of those states. I would really like to see people lobby for clergy misconduct laws because we found out in the therapeutic community, I'm a psychologist, I think it was up to the 70s before somebody complained about her therapist having sex with her and how what the damage that was done. And so it's definitely discouraged in the therapeutic community. And there are consequences. And it's very hard to impose any consequences on teachers who violate this boundary of trust. So there are, in 26 states, the sexual relationships between therapist and patient is criminalized. The seventh is the end justifies the means. You know, all this work we do, all this hardship we endure to do sesshin, it's worth it in the end. And sometimes, and I've heard this because I've been on national witness councils in exploring the abuses of Edo Shimano and Joshu Sasaki. Notice I left the Roshi off. I've been on the witness councils and talked to many women, dozens of women who have been in this situation and talked to them about the harm that was done. So it's a little bit like incest. But when you're in a position where you're supposed to be taking care of someone and you violate the trust by satisfying yourself, this is a problem. So in some of those communities, the end justifies the means was, well, his teaching has been great. It's been great for me. So, you know, so there's a few problems. And this reflects the cult-like adherence to the end justifies the means, and also reflects a zealous and unquestioning commitment to the leader. So these are things we need to be careful about. The last thing is group members are expected to devote inordinate amount of time to group activities. This takes a long time, and that's fine, as long as people also need to take care of the rest of their life. They shouldn't be sacrificing their life to be devoting inordinate amount of time. But what happens when you give inordinate amount of time or a large amount of time to a project, it becomes your center. And some of the tasks of adult development are missed on account of that. So all of these things are things we need to be careful about. And the only way we can be careful about it is by waking up and being aware. So I want to talk about the process of awareness, of developing the relationship with awareness. So the essence of our practice is a process for deepening your connection to awareness. And that results in your freedom, your ability to use it creatively in your daily life. So here are the four steps. The first step is finding the light of awareness. Well, what would that mean in simple terms? Before you came to meditation, you maybe did not have the experience of your brain watching itself. Now, what is it? You don't have two brains. There is something that's shining on the thoughts as they emerge. And this is awareness, because it doesn't necessarily come from your brain. There's something that happens when you sit down and do the practice that allows you to observe your own thoughts inside yourself. So Yunmon said it, everyone has their own light. If you look for it, you can't find it. So what does this mean? Because we're sitting on the cushion, but we're not looking for the light. We're becoming the light, in fact, actually. We're becoming united with the light. And the way we do that is actually by doing whatever practice we're doing, which is either shikantaza, or using koans, or breathing, or whatever it is we use. When we do that completely and sincerely, that is a manifestation of the light. So you're not looking for it saying, where is that thing? Where is that enlightenment? So it appears on its own, and this is why Yunmon cautioned against seeing it. And Yunmon was a teacher in, 8th, 9th century China. So your mind naturally reflects this light of awareness. And that's the first thing, is that when you sit down, who's watching whom? And what's watching? And what's seeing? And experiencing that light permeates your body and mind. That occurs reliably in meditation, except when we're really processing some stress. So you don't need to engage in extreme physical activities or go to the end of the earth to develop your familiarity with this brightening, self-reflective, and boundless quality of mind. So those are the characteristics that you will conclude, not while you're sitting, but after, that actually as you sit, there's a stronger wattage of the light because you're more connected to it. It's penetrating down to deeper levels of consciousness, and it has no limitations. This is sort of the difference between therapy and meditation, in that in therapy, you need to rely on the capacity of your therapist's mind to help you and your own. But we have the entire universe, the boundlessness of the entire universe, the light, to rely on as we continue our practice. So the important thing about this is that you find your own way in meditation rather than imitating something that your teacher does. One of the things that happens when we come together to practice like this, or as we had for the weekend, we have, first we find that light, but then we spend the time together amplifying it. So it's like we're turning up the dimmer switch here. We're getting it brighter by doing our practice together. I don't know how that works. We haven't yet figured out how coming together we actually lift each other up, but we do. You can feel something different when you're sitting with other people than you would on your own. So we come together and we do the practice that we do, the zazen we do, period after period, which amplifies the brightness of this light. You'll notice that your own sensory awareness has become stronger. And so I just wanted to give you one quote about how we do practice without attaching to an outcome. What is it like? What are the necessary conditions for amplifying this light? So I'm going to quote Dogen's great uncle, Hongzhir, a Chinese teacher, maybe 10th century, 11th, in his, and Taigen Layton translated this, Cultivating the Empty Field. And he said in his treatise, roam and play in samadhi, empty and desireless, cold and thin, simple and genuine, this is the way to strike down the habits of many lifetimes, or just this one, if that's how you're so inclined. When the stains from the old habits are exhausted, the original light appears. You can now connect to it. So the less we're fighting and creating a false self, the more we connect to it. The original light appears, blazing through your skull, not admitting any other matters. So this only happens after the discipline of applying yourself to the practice. And note that he says empty and desireless, not satiated in craving. He says cold and thin, not fat and sassy. And he says simple and genuine, not complicated and duplicitous. So these are all things that we're aware of as we practice with each other. It's very important we notice it with each other. When our personal ideas arise during Zazen, we don't push them away. Well, you might. It's true. But we try to bring the attention back to whichever style of meditation you're doing, rather than fighting with your thoughts and impulses and sensations as they arise. Put your trust in your breath. And I'm very sorry to report that we have had very few verified accounts of enlightenment while sitting in the hot tub having a glass of wine. I'm very sorry about that. I think it would be preferable. So we have a discipline, and it's work. But like any sport, you have to build your skills. So that is about amplifying. Now, the next thing we do is circulate that energy. We circulate the energy when we interact with others in our monastic practice environment. So doing the walking meditation with the mind of the cushion, or the mind of staying focused and being aware, is a way we circulate the awareness in our body. You also do that during Orioke. Sorry, probably not so much at a gourmet meal, but it definitely during Orioke. The awareness that we have to pay attention to each and every movement and the movement of others around us is a way that this becomes part of our body. So you may have noticed that in your own life that it seems to lurch towards disorder or disaster. That's what my granddaughter wrote on my cast. Scooter plus grandma equals disaster. She's a good mathematician. It was a true equation. So Suzuki Roshi used to teach, he said, we put everything in a boat, get into the boat, and then we go out to sea fully aware that the boat will sink. It's always falling apart. So we circulate this awareness. We pay attention to our life around us in everything we do. We try to apply this practice and feel the sensation in the body of circulating this awareness. That helps actually a lot. Sometimes people will come up and say something to you, oh, I really like this or that. I actually had an aunt who was perfect at this. She would come up and say things like, this was 50 years ago, but she would say things like, you're looking very well for a woman who's had two children. Or, oh, what a beautiful rug. This must have been when it was new. So you will develop an intuitive sense of your body, in your body, when you won't need the cues my aunt gave, but you will develop a sense of, is that person talking to me from a space, or are they trying to hide something? And this is very important information. So the circulating awareness is something we do definitely at the Zen Center. But the last part is about turning it loose in your life. How is it when you have to make life decisions that you actually trust your practice with your life? It's a very interesting experience. When I traveled to Japan, I thought I had disabilities, but now that I have this only one hand to use, I see, oh, you didn't have anything. But I did have problems with food. And my teacher in Berkeley used to say to me, if you just practiced harder, you would be able to eat this food. And I said, no, I wouldn't. And I'm going to prove it to you, because the last thing I do is I'm going to take a bite of tofu and I'm going to fart my way out of this life. I can't digest it, okay? And I didn't say to him, although maybe I should have, well, if you practice harder, maybe you wouldn't have needed a heart surgery. And if you practice harder, maybe you wouldn't have needed prostate surgery. But I didn't say those things. Instead, I went to practice in Japan and was very, very surprised when I told my teacher there, well, I can't eat soy, and I can't eat wheat, and I can't eat rice, and I can't eat milk, and I can't eat potatoes. I think all of this sort of hits exactly the jackpot of all the Zen food. And I think it's because I was a very bad monk in a previous life that snuck out to have my oysters and beef. And so now when I go into the monastery, I can't eat anything. Anyway, my teacher in Japan looked at me and he said, you can't eat those things? You can't eat with us. Now, I was in Japan, right? I mean, I didn't have my own kitchen. He said, you need to find a way to eat. Get yourself fed and then come here and sit. But I want you to have confidence in your sitting, you know, that you're not making yourself sick when you're on the cushion. So being honest and allowing your practice to guide you. So here it is. It took me to Japan because when I met Fukushima Kato Roshi, I said, this was like meeting Suzuki Roshi. It's like my whole life kind of shifted. The Roshiometer went off the scale. So I wanted to practice with him, and I trusted going to Japan, even though you do abandon all hope when you enter the monastery in Japan. I told people yesterday, I think it was yesterday, that, you know, I heard that one teacher using the stick on a student hit him on the head by mistake, and the student died. And there was no charges pressed against the teacher. It's like you enter the Zen monastery and you enter dangerously. But I trusted my practice to take me to Japan. And I said, well, I'm going to find out, you know, if this teacher will accept me as I am or not. I will trust where my practice is taking me. And so what I ended up doing in terms of trusting my practice after he said that to me was wandering around the neighborhood within a few minutes of the temple, 10 minutes of the temple. And when I saw women, I spoke enough of Japanese to ask, is there a family in this neighborhood? And so I got a Japanese wife. And they showed me the family inn, and she asked me what I needed so that I could continue my practice at Tofukuji. And I showed her, because I was planning to cook my food for the retreat, the sesshin of 7 days, and put it in the freezer. And she said, well, you can't do that. You need fresh food. I need to cook for you, and I need to shop for you, and I need to do your laundry. So truly, it became easier for me to do the retreat over there, the sesshin over there with a Japanese wife. And when we trust, you know, I had a lot of fear of taking my body to this harsh temple. But I said, well, either I'm going to find out that it's not going to work, or I'm going to find out that it's going to work, and I will trust that. So there are several ways to trust the practice. One is to be honest with your teacher or the people you're working with. And another is just to trust your breath with your life. It's like, how am I going to make this decision? I'm going to make this decision on the basis of practice versus the basis of my habits, my impulses, and so on. So this is how we circulate the awareness in our lives. So now it's time for you to do what you do, which is to help other people understand this talk by asking questions about things you didn't understand, because I always forget to say things. So I'll let you do that now. Yes.
Thank you for the talk. There was a part where you mentioned that the end justifies the mean, and that we are doing all this hard work for a certain end. It seems like that's enlightenment. But enlightenment is a word. We don't understand what it is.
We don't understand what it is?
Yeah, like when you're sitting, you don't know what that is.
Are you speaking for yourself?
Yes.
Good idea. When you're sitting.
So how does this reconcile or does end truly justify this?
Well, we have to be careful with it, that's all. We can't engage in cruelty as part of our discipline within the community. Even though we think, well, if it's harder for people, they'll somehow get clearer. So there is definitely work involved in this, and the work is the work of this moment, of being present this moment. There's no end and there's no means and no end. It's now. It's now. So when we wake up to now, we don't have to think about ends and means. And we can't, and we don't justify, well, I had to sit through that period and injure my knee, now I need surgery. Yes, that was before. I don't do it anymore. Because that's a really important, I need to look like good. This was an expression Suzuki Roshi had. I need to look like good. Well, it turns out most of the old Zen teachers I know have a sports injury in their knees, which is why it always hurts me to watch people bow without their zabutons under their knees. These bows that they do in Japan, they do on tatami, which is not a hardwood floor. And it doesn't take much, a quarter or an eighth of an inch, for you to smack that kneecap and start doing some damage there. So there isn't means that justify the end. There's being aware right now. Do you have something else to ask? Thank you. Yes, Bruce.
We put a great deal of emphasis on compassion, and rightly so, and treating others well. And this puts a great deal of pressure on people behave in a certain way, and then you turn around and talk about spiritual bypassing. What do you have to say about spiritual courage required to present an authentic self?
Yes. Well, there are characteristics that are necessary, and courage being one of them, effort being one of them, and compassion being one of them. But the thing about compassion is that we shouldn't study the meaning of compassion in order to do it. We should become compassionate with ourselves and know what it really means. Because once we have some realization of our connection to other people, we're naturally compassionate. We shouldn't be imitating what we think compassion is.
You're still putting that bypassing bit out.
What would you like me to say about the bypassing? Okay, so what I'm saying,
on your toe, you say yelp.
Yeah. So what I'm saying about the bypassing is don't imitate what you think compassion is. That's a spiritual bypass. And what you need to do is to become compassion yourself, towards yourself. Trim your ego back a little bit, gently and compassionately, and you will naturally feel your connection with other people. And because of that connection, compassion arises naturally. So when we try to imitate what we think Buddhism is about, that sucks. What we need to do is actually become the qualities, not read about them and imitate them. That's a bypass. That's not really feeling what's going on. which means also that if you're angry in community, you don't need to share that with everyone. You need to process it and find out what's at the bottom. Is it a childhood thing that's at the bottom and in buried in the wreck? Or is there some dynamic that's going on that you're not comfortable with? But when you've processed the anger, when you've actually been with it, you can know the difference, and then you can speak. So there's a lot of work involved. That's the effort with the courage in coming forward. But it's not helpful to just dump the raw material on other people. So we need to work it a bit. Yes.
You call this sport.
Yes.
I remember telling Tim Wicks I wanted to go to Pasar Harbor with him and do some competitive zen. I was being joking, of course. But I guess along with sport goes a whole range of things. And how do we take care of this sport?
Right, by building the skills. Right? So I don't encourage people to do even a weekend retreat until they've had some experience themselves sitting so they know what's good pain and what isn't. So there are skills that are necessary. By the way, you should be sitting in a way that's comfortable. Your knees are a non-renewable resource, so don't stress them out. I say as one who has. And my teacher in Japan, when I came back from my knee surgery, I started to bow to him. He said, "Don't bow." I said, "Oh, you know," in Japanese, I said, "Oh, I just had surgery. I'm okay." And then he screamed at me, "Don't bow!" And that really has stayed with me for my own students. That's why it hurts me when you bow on the hardwood floor, because I remember what my teacher said. And because what we should do, the skill is, you are the only one inside this body. You're the only one who can take care of yourself. And sometimes we feel frustrated because we want other people to do that for us. But what we need to do is first develop the skill of being with ourselves and knowing what we need. And then we can actually ask for it and not have some magical thinking about how other people should take care of us. So the other skills we need to develop are physical activities, yoga, tai chi, walking, whatever works to help you sustain your body, because if you're going to practice your whole life, you're going to need something. You do anyway as you age. And if you don't die, you need to keep exercising for your whole life, but particularly in this practice. And we had a yoga teacher this weekend who had Parkinson's. And he's actually the one who encouraged me, just by being himself, to do this retreat. And his skill was this courage of not trying to look good. He just did yoga. He did yoga with a severe tremor. He did yoga with his body bent over. He was not showing off as a yoga stud. He was a person who was confronting his limitations in a way that could inspire all of us. So that's another skill, the skill of accepting yourself in whatever limitations arise. Is that enough skill?
Well, you also, when you were preparing this retreat, and even today, you said 30 minutes is enough.
Yes. Well, I'm stretching it a little, because Robert Akinroshi said 25 minutes, more than 25 minutes, and you risk damaging your joints. And I know when my teacher came to one of my first sittings in my own Zendo, he said, "Your people are only sitting 30 minutes. They'll never learn to sit 40 minutes," as if that was somehow the penultimate goal. I said, "Well, I don't want them to learn how to sit 40 minutes. That's why they're sitting 30 minutes. That's enough." And sometimes only 10 minutes is enough. And as my teacher Fukushima Roshi said in Japan, 3 minutes zazen is also good. And I encourage the students I teach at Stanford, Juanito is one of them, or he's graduated now, that you do check in with your breath when you're crossing campus. Check in with your breath when you're sitting at a stoplight, either on your scooter or in your car. Be present and use your practice during the day. That encourages the habit of turning the awareness on or tuning into it. You were going to say something.
Your teacher was Darlene Cohen?
My teacher, Darlene Cohen was my Dharma sister. My teacher is Sojin Mel Weitzman, and you've never seen two people fight as much as we do and stay together. And my teacher in Japan is deceased, Keita Fukushima Roshi. My husband and I worked on his talks, and so that book is there, and I highly recommend it. It's a very clear teaching on Zen practice.
I remember reading Darlene's book, Finding Joy in the Heart of Pain, and reading about her story. And I was wondering if you would share your thoughts about what you have learned about suffering, about
Yes, I have a chapter in my upcoming book. My upcoming book is Naked in the Zendo. And it's not only about being naked, because inspired the chapter was one time at Berkeley Zen Center, the cook came out to do his bows. The cook comes out at Berkeley and does three bows. And at the third bow, his sweatpants were on his ankles. And he did have underwear on. I was a server, so I was standing right next to him and saw a lot of people were just doing their chant and didn't see it. So that's what inspired the chapter, because after the meal, when I went out and I saw him, he left the Zendo shortly after that. He didn't stay for the meal. I said, "What happened?" And he said, "Well, I felt my pants is a little loose, the drawstring was a little loose, so I took a big breath. But by the third bow, I let the breath out." So his pants fell off. So here's the thing. I don't think you can top that. And I realized then, I can't top this. Even though sometimes when I'm serving the abbot, I pour boiling water on him, I can't top this. So this is what inspired me to think about how we try to cover up our mistakes and how important it is that we expose ourselves. So in terms of suffering, actually the book was inspired by Darlene's teaching. I was going to call the book The Foot in the Air, and it went through various iterations, but the Shambhala folks said Naked in the Zendo is, you know, they're about sales, right? What lurid tales will people see in this? Sorry, not really. So, and also there's a chapter on Jhana, and Jhana, who was here, Jhana Draka, where I was at Tassajara with Jhana. And on April Fool's Day, she taped the door to my cabin shut. And you know, when you're doing monastic practice period, you time your pee breaks. So she made me laugh so hard I wet myself. So that was Jhana, who went on to taking on homelessness. But Darlene's teaching to me, the very powerful teaching, that I was talking to her about my shoes. And I said, "Damn, you know, I've got these cute shoes, but they make my back go out." She said, "That's a price of wearing cute shoes. You got to pay the price." But she also said, you know, when she was in her full-on rheumatoid arthritis, which her mother had had, so she didn't really see a way out. And who knows whether there is or not, you know, whether there's some cure. But anyway, she would walk from her apartment, which was Zen Center owned and therefore right there on Page Street. She would walk from there to the Zendo, the Zen Center, and sometimes she couldn't get up the steps to go meditate because it was just too painful. So she would meditate in her room, just following the light or whatever she did as her practice. And then she developed enough skill to be able to bring her awareness to the foot that was in the air rather than the foot that was on the concrete step, the brick step at Zen Center. And this is how she developed her practice, tapping into the awareness and moving it to where it needed to be highlighted in the body. Yes?
It just seems to me that this copying, which is different than maybe, but it leads towards authenticity. So ritual, and even though it says 40 minutes, I find that that's a way of actually, in tightening, I learn to loosen.
Uh-huh.
So,
Well, I'm not telling you you can't sit 40 minutes. It's fine with me. It's a good, people need, as I said, you need to find your way with your own practice.
Right.
You may find, after sitting many years of 40 minutes, that you can't sit 40 minutes anymore. And there is, you do have a physical body. And it's one thing to hurt your knees so that you can't sit in Zazen. It's another thing to hurt your knees so you can't walk and play with your grandchildren. So I just caution you. Right now, they haven't figured out a way except by cutting through your bone and putting in an artificial joint to repair those injuries.
Where is ritual? Where is the redeeming value in ritual?
Oh, ritual?
Yeah.
We go beyond time and space. In a ritual. When we do a ritual, this is something that's been done for thousands of years everywhere on the planet, and we enter that. Ritual is very important, and Zazen itself is a ritual.
Orioki?
Yes. Oh, I love it.
When I first learned Orioki, I was really tight, and then as I got looser, I dropped chopsticks.
Yeah.
And that was okay.
Yeah. Well, the practice works.
That's what practice is, right?
Yes. Yes, but as the Buddha said, when you have an instrument, you don't keep the strings too tight or too loose. So I would rather let people find their way to that discipline than have it come from me. So I create some, and then let them work their way with it. I think that, for me, is about awareness of yourself. And what works for you may not work for someone else, but how do they practice with the community if they can't sit 40 minutes?
It's an interface.
Yeah. It's alive.
Yeah.
It's alive. And so keeping to something that's too strict, not so good. Something that's too loose, not so good. So how do we find our way together as a community so that we're inclusive, but we also offer the discipline needed? Yes?
You were talking earlier about not tolerating bad behavior of teachers. Some years ago I read the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and then lots of wisdom, lots of beauty in that book, but then learned that Sogyal Rinpoche seems to be a pretty terrible person in terms of his behavior towards his students. Do you think that undermines the wisdom in the book?
Yeah, this is a really tough question because the way we summarize it in Zen is, can you get pure water from a rusty pipe? And yes, you can. But at some point, it becomes polluted, doesn't it? So these teachings from these teachers that were violators, Shimano in New York, and Sasaki in California, and Sogyal, he was in France, I think, And now we're finding out about Shambhala and the abuse of children, sexual abuse of children. And he's hightailed it to Asia, so he can't be arrested. But there's a big brouhaha in that community, and they're reporting on it. And I'm working with another group who's reporting another teacher, and the attorney from Shambhala is helping these women. But in any case, those teachings, beautiful as they may be somewhat divorced from human behavior. That's my suspicion, that they're beautiful and they seem kind of glittery, but they're actually a little disconnected from human emotion. Yes.
That actually leads into a thought that I was having about your discussion of spiritual bypassing. The way that you...
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.